Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the CIG Insider NJ podcast, brought to you by Capital Impact Group and Insider NJ. I'm your host, Paul Krupe, and we have a terrific episode for you today as Senate Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg joins me for a wide-ranging conversation focusing on her long career in politics. Senator Weinberg has been in public service for over five decades, and she talks about everything from her early days as an activist and TNEC to fighting corruption as a state senator and chairing the investigation of the Bridgegate scandal. She also touches on the current investigation into the hiring practices of the Murphy administration and discusses what it will take for the governor and the legislature to put aside their differences and work together. We recorded this podcast on December 12th in her district office in Teaneck, and her office is filled with memorabilia collected from a lifetime of public service, including pictures with presidents, notes from longtime allies in state government, and bright orange traffic cones to commemorate her time spent investigating the politically motivated closure of the George Washington Bridge. She also has a picture that was taken long ago of herself and her young daughter standing on a street corner protesting on behalf of farm workers. We talk about that photo, and it really is a testament to a lifetime of standing up for the most disadvantaged and vulnerable populations in New Jersey. So I hope you enjoy the episode. And without further ado, here is Senator Loretta Weinberg. So, Senator Loretta Weinberg, thank you very much for being the second guest on the podcast. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
You've had really an extraordinary career in New Jersey, and you continue to have that career. So we're going to get to all that. First, I want to start from the beginning.
That'll be a long time ago.
And I've done a little research, and I understand you were born in New York City, in the Bronx.
I was.
And you lived there for about 10 years or so.
About 8 or 9 years, mm-hmm. Right.
And your parents, your mom was from Ukraine. She's an immigrant, right?
Yes, she came over here as a very young child, but she was an immigrant, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your parents split up.
My parents were divorced, and my mom, who was a single mom, mm-hmm. to children before it was quite that fashionable, moved us to California. She was a kind of a pioneer, a little bit
sure.
nuts.
Mm. I mean, at that time, divorce itself was rare.
Very rare.
And for her to be a single mother,
yes.
who was an immigrant, pick up and move across the country, I think is pretty extraordinary.
It was an extraordinary story, and she built a life out there, and that's where I did most of my formative years, went to middle school, high school, and college in California.
Why California? Just because it was...
I think it was as far away as you could get.
As far away from...
and still remain in the United States.
Right. So you moved out to Beverly Hills.
Yes, we lived in a place called Beverly Wood.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people Beverly Hills High School before zip codes.
Right.
We had no zip codes in those days.
Right. And did you have any classmates who were kids of celebrities or producers or directors?
Yeah, actually a lot, but one of my classmates who became a celebrity in his own right was Richard Chamberlain, mm-hmm. Who became a fairly well-known actor, Dr. Kildare,
TV actor,
in
yeah.
the old days of the TV and many other things.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought of him as kind of nerdy because he was the Chief Justice of the Student Court, where we got sent for infractions of the rules. And I made at least one trip there myself, but I won't share with your audience what it was about.
It'll be a different podcast.
Yeah.
So it must have been a culture shock for you to grow up in the Bronx, and you're 9 years old, so of course I'm sure you remember it, and then to move out to California. And at the time, I guess it wasn't as, this probably would be in the late 40s, so it wasn't
yes,
as built up.
It was soon after World War II.
Okay.
Right.
So it certainly wasn't as built up as it is now.
No, in fact, probably one of the biggest regrets is we didn't buy a couple of acres
sure, yeah.
out there at the time.
Mm-hmm. What was the hardest thing for you moving out there?
Actually, one of the things that I remember most is because of the divorce,
mm-hmm.
that a good many of the young people I made friends with in school and so on were children of divorce, too. I was not quite as unique
mm-hmm.
as I felt in the
in New York.
Growing up in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
So it sort of, you know, it was ameliorated a little bit
right.
in that respect.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to college there. You went to Berkeley, I believe.
I went to Berkeley for 2 years mm-hmm. and then transferred to UCLA. and I graduated UCLA.
Was Berkeley the Berkeley it is today?
No, I went to Berkeley in the 50s, okay. So I often tell people that I was there to soften it up and to get it ready for the 60s. But we had I still remember this, I had a history professor. His name was Dr. Hitchcock. And he gave us a big lecture because we were the uninvolved generation. And he talked about how he had gone to school in the 30s and how involved they were in what was going on in the world around them, and that we were just kind of a bunch of dunces who didn't seem to really be aware of what our surroundings were. I always remember the lecture, and I often wondered as we got into the 60s what he was telling his students at that point.
Right, right. You went a little too far.
Yeah. That's right. This is not exactly what I meant.
Right, right. Interesting. So what did your mom do out there while she was raising you?
She had all kinds of jobs. That she ran a landscape nursery at one point. Interestingly enough, tried to buy the piece of property where the landscape nursery was located to continue the business, and could not, as a single mom, a single woman, she could not get credit.
Wow.
I don't even think she had a credit card at that point. In fact, I remember when I was married and my mother sending a wedding present of linens that she had bought for me, which she bought in Saks Fifth Avenue in California, not because we shopped in such high-class stores, but it was the only place that had a charge account
at the time.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, yes. So she really was a trailblazer in many respects.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible. What did you study at Berkeley and then UCLA?
History and political science.
Of course.
Yeah. People say to me, well, who were your heroes, role models? And I laughingly say, but there's an element of seriousness, Brenda Starr, girl reporter. She was a comic strip character. She was a newspaper reporter that seemed in the comic strips to lead a very exciting life running around covering news stories. She had wild red hair in the comic strip. And so she was kind of my, it sounds neat. So I think I planned to become a journalist at that point.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And then after college, what was your next step?
After college, I went to Europe.
Okay.
With a friend. We hitchhiked through Europe for about 3 months.
Wow.
On $700.
Can't do that anymore.
That we had saved, that I had saved. And, as I was before, we knew about sex perverts and axe murderers. So it was kind of an acceptable. Hitchhiking didn't mean you went out on the road with your thumb. You would go to American Express office, wherever you were, and sign up that you need a ride to the next town, willing to split expenses. And that's how we traveled around Europe. And so it was a pretty exciting kind of, I was in Hungary, or I was in Vienna when the Hungarian Revolution took place. And actually the border was open for a couple of days. We actually were able to cross over.
Wow.
So there was some, pretty exciting adventures.
Yeah.
And when I came back from Europe, we came back to New York. And I had a friend from California who was living in the city. So I decided I would try to stay in New York, knowing at that point in that era, if I went home, I would have to move home.
Right.
This way, being in New York, I could kind of maintain some independence.
Was it a temporary move, you thought? You'd stay in New York for a while?
I wasn't sure. I don't know that I made any long-range plans. Mm-hmm. I never made too many long-range plans about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I laugh at myself now. I went to an employment agency and said I would like a job between 42nd and 50th Street between 5th and Madison. Because that also looked like a really kind of fun place to work.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my parameter. And they sent me to a trade publication from which I got a job as a receptionist running the switchboard.
Mm-hmm.
And was promoted pretty quickly and then offered a job at Scientific American magazine as the assistant to the advertising manager.
Interesting.
And I stayed there for a number of years, married, got pregnant.
So was this, I guess this was the Mad Men era? so to speak.
Oh yes, yeah. Very much the Madman era.
And,
yes,
and pretty accurate to the
very accurate. And as I said, you know, I often described, even when I did my own Me Too moment and mm-hmm. on Facebook. I grew up in an era that we didn't know that we could do much about it. Mm-hmm. And more important, we didn't know that we should do much about it.
Right.
That's changed a lot.
An accepted part of culture.
Yeah, when I look at publicly going from Anita Hill to Christine Blasey Ford to Katie Brennan, however they worked out, they know that they should. And that's a big step forward.
Right, right. And that wasn't the case when you were,
absolutely. Now, it wouldn't have occurred to me.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. So,
I said, I describe our, the reaction to that is you made sure you were near a doorway.
Mm-hmm.
That was the best advice that you could get so you could get out.
Quick exit.
Yeah, quick exit.
Very interesting. So you got married. You had kids, and then you came out here to Teaneck?
To Teaneck, yes, got married. We lived on West 75th Street,
mm-hmm.
had became pregnant with my first child, and we moved to Yonkers. We had an apartment there for a while, gave birth to my second child. We moved into a brand-new building, and I think about 30 children were born in that three-year lease. We used to laugh that you couldn't go down in the elevator at night without meeting somebody else in labor on her way to the hospital, that there was something in the washing machines. But so we spent the first 3 years there, and then time to buy a house. People could afford that in those days without the generous in-laws. And my husband was a veteran of the Korean War, had the GI mortgage. And we bought a house in Teaneck because I had relatives who lived there.
Okay.
And it was geographically suitable. My husband traveled around a bit in his job. And it was the kind of integrated, you know, the whole movement forward kind of community that I wanted to live in.
Mm-hmm. So that I was going to ask, what was Teaneck like at this time? Was it
filled
sort of
with activists?
Okay.
It was the beginning of the school integration movement. We were the first town to voluntarily go to the first town in the United States to voluntarily go to the polls and integrate our schools.
Wow.
There was the whole women's rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the picture over there of me with a small child on Don't Eat Grapes While Grape Pickers Go Hungry, picketing the local supermarket. With my daughter wearing the sign, yes. And when I had that photograph restored, she said to me, why was I the one wearing the sign that says, don't eat grapes while grape pickers go hungry? And I told her, that's why you have children.
That's right, to wear the signs.
Just to wear the sign. But, you know, fast forward 40 years or more, we're still discussing whether farm workers get covered under minimum wage.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Still a relevant topic.
Still relevant.
So it seemed like you really jumped feet first into the activist movement.
Yeah, when I moved to Teaneck and felt that we had set down roots in a community and this was going to be our home, and all of this was going on, it was hard not to be involved. It's where we spent time feeling like we were really accomplishing things.
Mm-hmm. You felt like
bettering
you're staking
our schools.
Yeah.
The Vietnam War that finally ended, the civil rights movement that, with a lot of anguish and loss of life, finally moved forward. So, and it was where we built our social life, too.
Mm-hmm.
We were most of us at that point, stay-at-home moms. So we used to sit in whose ever backyard with the kids running around in the days before computer voting sheets, filling out 3x5 cards for all the voters in our district and doing all the, you know, drudge work of campaigns that so much is done now electronically.
So you felt like you had some responsibility because you lived in the community and you enjoyed raising your family there and you wanted to make sure that it was in good hands going forward.
Exactly. And it was interesting. It kept those of us who needed the challenge beyond being a stay-at-home mom, not that that isn't a big enough challenge, and this became kind of a joke with my children, that mom used to say, we're so busy building a better world for you, I don't quite have time for you right now. So, right. So I used to say, you can work it out in therapy. It's okay.
Just carry this on.
Yeah, right.
That's terrific. So you got involved when you started out on the grassroots level.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Going door to door.
That's exactly, climbing up and down stairs. Mm-hmm. The first school board election I went to, my assignment that I worked in, and this was the one that move toward integrating our schools, my assignment was to go into a series of apartments that still exist in a section of Teaneck, go up and down these dark stairs, and hang a door hanger on the doors saying tomorrow's election day, mm-hmm. and then going back on election day urging these people to vote. And I remember I knocked on one door, and a woman said to me, I can't come today, can I make it tomorrow? My first real insight into, no, we don't have two-day elections.
Right,
on
right.
Some of the electorate that's really not tuned in.
Voter apathy.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was your husband involved too, or is this just really?
Much more to a limited extent. He was much more involved in his business. He used to say, we have a division of responsibility here. My wife worries about the big issues, like how we're going to end the war in Vietnam, and I worry about the small issues, like how we pay our mortgage.
Right.
So, and that's true. And when my husband passed away almost 20 years ago, my kids at one point said to me, you don't even have an ATM card. So I said, well, my ATM card was the top of my husband's bureau. Mm-hmm. I put my hand there, and there was always a $20 bill. Hence I learned how to use an ATM soon after.
Right, right, right. Interesting. So your first real job in politics and public service was what?
My first, you mean like paid job?
Paid job, yeah. So you did a lot of volunteer stuff.
I did a lot. I was a campaign person for Mattie Feldman, one of his early, but they were all volunteer works. Mm-hmm. My first real job was a part-time position with then-Congressman Henry Holstosky, okay. who was from South Bergen, a real blue-collar area, but was stood up on the floor of Congress, voting against the House Un-American Activities. Quite a liberal, particularly because of the kind of area he came from. He's since passed on, but that I had a part-time job in the local congressional office.
Had you always had these, I guess, liberal sensibilities growing up? Was it from your mother, or was it something that more, as you learned more and more about the issues, then that's how you became more informed?
You know, in some ways, I think it's in my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
I just, it was always the things I believed in.
Right, right.
And we haven't mentioned it, but I had a father, too, who, although he lived in New York, we did have visitation mm-hmm. and so on. And he was very active in the old backroom politics of the Bronx.
Okay.
During his years in politics. So probably some of the political stuff came from him. Later years, when after I was married, we used to go to political dinners for my father sometimes,
okay.
and my husband went so he could get dinner. So he used to kid that, you know, he watched my father and me work the room while he ate dinner.
Was he an elected official, or was he just...
No, point, okay. Yeah, worked in the old Bronx Democratic...
Interesting.
Ward politics.
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so definitely picked up some of that
yeah.
from your dad.
Right.
Interesting. And then at one point you worked for the county. You got a job in Bergen County.
Yes, that was further on. My
okay.
children, we won. I worked very hard in a campaign. I worked at the Bergen County Democratic Organization. Barbara Werber, first female county leader we had. And we won control of the county. I think the Democrats took control for the first time in something like 50 years, 5-0.
Wow.
considering where we are today.
Right.
That was quite a step forward. It was under the old freeholder director form of government before we had a county executive. And the then freeholder, the man who became freeholder director, Jeremiah O'Connor, who had also been a state senator, he offered to me to become the clerk to the board. And my initial was the who to the what and what do they do? And he actually had to spend some time talking me into it and finally agreed with my husband's agreeing. And I went to work for the Bergen County Board of Freeholders. So my first real mentor in government was a man. It was Jerry O'Connor. Mm-hmm. And he's still around, thankfully, not in the political scene, but still very much around. And he and his wife are very close friends of mine to this day. But it was a period of time when there was a lot of federal money coming in to the counties under the old Comprehensive Employment Training Act, community development money. It all began then. It's a period of 1975 to 80. And he was so creative. He got all of this money through community development into Bergen County. It was the first regional setup because there was no town in Bergen that was large enough to qualify. So they put us into regions. We qualified for the money. And we created the first office on women, the first affirmative action program, the first beginnings of the first domestic violence program, the first office on, not office on aging, office on women. And Jerry was one of those, look, this is the need, go ahead and do it.
Right.
And he didn't breathe over your shoulder unless you needed him to move something. So it was such a tremendous, wonderful time to watch government actually doing things.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, those issues really hadn't been on the forefront.
That's right. Domestic violence.
Right.
The woman who started that in Bergen, her name was Sandy Ramos, still Sandy Ramos as far as I know. She used to come to freeholder meetings. She lived in Hackensack, and she would bring victims of domestic violence with her. And she would say, what am I supposed to do? And freeholder director O'Connor used to say, see Mrs. Weinberg at the end of the meeting. And I used to say, well, short of my taking them home, we're going to have to create something here.
Interesting.
And we got the federal money. We were able to, we started the first residence for victims of domestic violence, and it's still in action.
When was this about?
Probably around 1977, 78.
Yeah.
Still, you know, but what was then known as Shelter Our Sisters has grown tremendously. They still have the main residence. They have many second stage housing for women coming out of the main residence with their children and need some transitional housing. It's a huge program, as it has flourished all over the state of New Jersey,
right,
but it really came
in the state.
Out of the advocate coming to a freeholder meeting and talking to us, saying, what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to have, first, the ability, because the funding was there without raising people's taxes, and then to have the kind of leadership that we had with Jerry O'Connor was a rare joining together, and I was really privileged to be part of that. And it gave me a sense of, you know what, government really can do stuff.
It works.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. that's great. So you were the clerk to the freeholder board for how long approximately?
From 1975 to about 84.
Okay.
Assistant county administrator. Okay. Ran into a little problem when the Republicans took over, eventually left. And then, you know, as kind of semi-retirement from public employment, but I continued my activism. And in 1990, I decided to run for council in Teaneck. I had worked for so many other people. I said to myself,
You can do
many
this.
Of whom yeah. really disappointed me. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, it's time. You know, my kids are kind of grown. It's time for me to run myself. It was 19. We have nonpartisan elections in Teaneck. Mm-hmm. So we file in March for May elections. So I filed along with the slate of people. And there was a shooting in April. A policeman shot an African-American young man in the back.
Wow. This was 1990?
April 1990. Wow. So I often say I filed for office in one town, and I got elected almost in a different community, or at least that was the feel. We had national press. We were a mini Ferguson before Ferguson.
Sure, yeah.
We had an acting prosecutor, so a whole lot of actings at that point. And it was a very unsettled time. We had a mini cars overturned, kids acting out, period of time. And it was all right before the election. I was elected in April. And we televised our council meetings even then.
Really?
Yes. And people, the lineups to come to testify, they'd be out the door. And sometimes, particularly that summer when the weather was warm, you could see people show up in kind of funny outfits. It's like they were home watching on TV. And they felt the need, you know, to throw their pajama, their Bermuda shorts on over their pajama bottoms and come out and testify about something. And we had everybody from the most ultra, ultra right winger to Al Sharpton appearing before our
literally
council.
Al Sharpton.
Yes,
wow.
Literally. The old Al Sharpton, not this one.
Right.
So it was a huge time of learning, mm-hmm. of listening. Mm-hmm. I think I really learned how to listen to people sitting on that council, which more elected officials, including our local ones.
You were being elected to a community that needed a lot of healing.
And there was a tremendous upheaval from our police department that had felt neglected, from the African American community that felt put upon. And I've told this story a number of times. It was a woman that I knew fairly well, an African American woman, contemporary of mine, kids like my kids' ages. Same socioeconomic background. We have very middle-class minority community here. Pardon me. And we were chatting one day about all this, and she said to me, she had two sons. I teach my children to hold their money in their hand when they walk into a store so they won't be accused of shoplifting. Yeah, well, you got a raised eyebrow. That really shocked me. I remember it all of these years.
Right.
So I thought, we were living in the same community. We are similar people, I thought. Wouldn't have occurred to me that I had to teach my children a defensive mechanism when they're walking into a retail store. They wouldn't have been accused of shoplifting unless they were shoplifting. Mm-hmm. So it was such an eye-opener to me that such, with all the stories I heard, so significant to me that we came from I thought was the same background. Our kids went to the same schools. Mm-hmm. We both lived in typical middle-class teenage houses on small lots.
And completely different experiences.
And completely different experiences, yes. So that period of time on the council from 1990 to 1994 is when we started raising issues about building a community center, which stands in Teaneck today, the Rota Center, a beautiful building now in need of repair, where we built a new police department. The police had been really not nourished well, and I don't mean that in terms of food, but in terms of resources. I remember visiting the old police department. They had in the lower level where their lockers were, they had pallets on the floor because there was always water there.
Wow.
So there were a lot of things that needed addressing, a lot of things that had gone by the wayside. And we had been held up, don't forget, go backwards to when I said the 60s, mm-hmm. where we were the first town to voluntarily integrate our schools. Now we're in 1990, where there was a lot of things we let go.
Right.
And I also learned that diversity needs constant nourishment. It needs constant ability to keep it going. You can't just say, okay, now we are a diverse community, we can all relax. Not so.
How does it make you feel that we're still dealing with these issues today? I mean, these very same issues today. They're still so prevalent.
Well, you know, part of, I look at the optimistic mm-hmm. side, the things we have accomplished when I look at my own legislative issues that have been signed into law and have actually affected people's lives. So I have a sense of optimism generally. And I think if you don't have a sense of optimism, you shouldn't be in this business. So I, you know, try to concentrate on the changes we can make and the ones we have made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then you joined the state legislature.
1992.
The assembly seat opened up.
Bennett Mazur resigned mm-hmm. because of illness. And we had what the law requires, a convention. And two or three other people ran, and all men. And I won the convention, much to my surprise and everybody else's.
Was it just sort of like on a whim that you saw the seat
well,
was opening
it,
up?
Well, there
you
it was. It was
another challenge?
Yeah, it was. It came open.
Mm-hmm.
The opportunity was there. And I guess something else I've learned that I've tried to impart when I talk particularly to women's groups, that when the door opens, walk through it. Put your toe in there, even if it's scary, which it is mm-hmm. from time to time. But you've got to take advantage of those opportunities.
You don't know how long it'll be open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't usually get invited to the dance, you know, with a big engraved invitation, at least not too often.
Mm-hmm.
So I've won the convention. I won the election. At that point, dual office holding was legal,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the council. So I decided I didn't want to leave midway. I had running mates who were there. We were a three-member minority out of a seven-member council. But at the end of my term, I determined that I wasn't going to run again for local office. And I will tell you that I found real conflicts of interest, not in terms of, you know, some bags of money or something, mm-hmm. but in terms of sometimes I might have voted on a local issue one way if I hadn't been on the legislature, or vice versa.
Interesting.
Sometimes I might have voted in the legislature differently if I hadn't been on the local council. So I found there were really real conflicts. Mm. I think dual office holding is really not good.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't run again for council.
And they didn't get rid of that until...
Well, we still have dual office.
They were grandfathered in, right, but that wasn't in the early 2000s, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Right. Interesting. And any specific landmark issues when you're in the assembly working on?
Well, when I came into the assembly, there were 22 Democrats out of 80.
Mm.
So
basically the opposite of what it is now.
We didn't have too many landmarks to, you know, talk about irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
We were pretty irrelevant. But I actually did get something done, and was an overhaul of the jury system, which put everybody, it did away with all the exemptions that had grown up over the years. In order to put everybody into the jury system, and I got plenty of grief about that, some years later I had a assembly running mate who was a police chief who called me one day. I just got a jury duty notice. Well, don't complain. And some of that came out of the Tina case. There had been, I think, two grand juries that investigated that shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people didn't have faith in the jury system. So what we decided the best answer is if you can get everybody in, then at least you'll have a cross-section of the public represented. So that was one of the few things I think I was able to accomplish. There was one of the first sexual harassment issues that against the then Republican speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my assembly colleagues and I kind of went after that. And another thing I learned, because my own party leadership said to me, you really shouldn't do this, you'll never get a bill posted. So I like said, let me get this straight.
Right.
We have a sexual harasser here. I had read the depositions, and I'm in trouble.
Interesting.
There's something wrong with that picture.
Right.
Another lesson learned, that the best way to do that is just stand up.
So you were never one to bow to pressure at all?
No. Now, I'm not Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't been publicly burned at the stake yet. But I think I've learned to pick my battles, mm-hmm. that I can't make a battle over everything. So I pick and choose what I think is important, and then I don't bow to pressure.
Right, right. And then speaking of bowing to pressure, when you joined the Senate, it was under some interesting circumstances.
Yes. Again, at that point, my predecessor was Senator Byron Beer, who, same circumstance, had to resign because of illness. And again, a convention is convened. I only had a county leader who didn't want me in the Senate because he didn't want somebody who didn't listen, mm-hmm. or was perceived as not listening to him. So the convention was wrought with problems. There were, the law requires that just county committee people vote in that convention. And there were all kinds of what turned out to be forgeries, wow. resigning people from the county committee. And it started out with a man who's since passed on, who was a great guy. He was Timothy J. Driscoll. He was a county committee man in Bergenfield. And he called me, and I had never met him, at least not to my knowledge. And he said to me, can they replace me on the county committee? So I said, well, not if you were duly elected in the June primary, no. So he said, well, I told somebody I was going to vote for you. So they told me, don't bother coming. They're replacing me. So I said, Mr. Driscoll, by all means, come. They can't replace you. And I forgot about it. Fast forward to the day before the convention. We finally get the list of who they deemed were duly elected delegates, mm-hmm. county committee people. And I opened the list, and towns were listed alphabetically. So Bergenfield, which is no longer in the district, was the first town. And there I see Timothy J. Driscoll resigned, has been replaced. I thought, oh, he's an older guy, maybe. Mm-hmm. He didn't remember that he mm-hmm. resigned. So we called him. He spoke with a slight Irish brogue and said, what are you talking about? I never resigned. So I said, well, I'm going to fax this to you. Would you please look at it and see if it's your signature? Because there was his resignation. So he had one of those old-fashioned fax machines where you had to go unplug your phone right. and plug in. Mm-hmm. So you had to go upstairs. That mm-hmm. took time. We get it faxed to him, and then, of course, we can't call him because he didn't unplug his right. fax machine. The line is busy, but we finally got – I almost was going to go to his house. Said, that is not my signature.
Wow.
It was signed Tim J. or Tim Driscoll. He said, I always sign Timothy J. Driscoll.
Wow.
So that's what started it. And we found several irregularities. There were two parts to the convention – choosing the replacement for Byron Beer from that period, whenever we were October to mm-hmm. January, and then choosing somebody to run in the November election.
For the full term.
Anyway, I lost the convention by one vote, one part of it, and the other one by three votes. And there were five votes in Tenafly that were also in question. Congressman Steve Rothman was the chair of the convention. So he held those five votes aside because of this whole discussion. And we had to go to court. I was pretty sure that they were my votes. Mm-hmm. We had to go to court and have, well, we appeared before the then assignment judge, was Judge Peter Duane. And he deemed this is a party matter, so the courts don't get involved. My attorney, who to this day I owe a great deal of gratitude to, is known in the state of New Jersey, Angela Genova.
Sure, yeah.
said to me, you should appeal to the appellate court. I think you have a really good case. At that point, another aside, John Corzine was the governor who had kind of urged this onward, wanted to, you know, I'm supporting a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But then I started actually to get some calls, not from him, but from a couple of staffers. Oh, you don't want to prolong this. You made your point.
Interesting.
So I thought about it for quite a while because, I mean, I was still an assemblywoman.
You'd have
so
to give up your seat.
Yeah, right. Yeah, on whether or not I'm going to appeal mm-hmm. or not.
Right, right, right.
And it was Angela who talked me into it. He said to me, this is a good case.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I, meaning him, I can't walk away from this a loser.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll do you a favor, Angela, we'll appeal. And it went up to the appellate court. And they deemed, no, it's not a party matter. You are picking a new senator.
Right.
And that what they did is remand it back to the Superior Court just to determine if those five votes were appropriate. And we had a full three-day trial over this with my Bergen County Democrats mm-hmm. going on the other side.
Right, right. The whole party was really
lined against
opposition.
Me. Yeah,
yeah.
And a lot of women helped. I had a lot of female lawyer friends who helped Angelo, even though he was the lead person,
mm-hmm.
as volunteers, by the way. And the court said, yeah, these, because all the judge had to decide was were these duly elected appropriate delegates, and they were. So then comes time to open the envelopes, which had been sealed. I thought, oh, my God.
You didn't even know if the votes were yours.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I was pretty sure they were mine. But I had that moment of, oh, suppose they didn't vote for me.
Right.
So they became famous, the Tenafly Five, as they were called. And, of
and
course,
they were all for you.
Yeah, yeah. And so I won the convention, one part by two votes, I think, and the other by one vote.
Wow.
And they tried to appeal to the Supreme Court, but they declined. This very large case,
mm-hmm.
the Supreme Court declined. So,
so then you were in the Senate. How did that affect your relationship with the county organization?
Well, not exactly warm.
Sure.
Nor might I tell you, did I get a warm welcome from my colleagues when I walked into the Senate?
Mm.
Because after all, I was this, you know, girl, uppity, mm-hmm. beat our friends, you know.
Right. And taking on the establishment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they weren't exactly all happy to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I was told the day I walked into the caucus, just remember, you're not coming in here with seniority. In other words, my years in the assembly.
Right.
By that time, the Democrats were in charge. I had chaired the health committee in the assembly. So remember, you're not coming in here with seniority. And you have to start all over again. And I remember my very snappy reply was, I will try to forget everything I know. And it wasn't like I came in, you know, on a white horse.
Right.
I knew what the rules were.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come in asking for anything other than a seat and, you know, the same microphone everybody else had.
Absolutely.
So it took me a while to make friends with people. Mm-hmm. And I always find that, you know, another thing, it's hard to impart or teach, but humor gets you through a lot.
Yeah.
Kind of making fun of yourself,
mm-hmm.
being able to keep it a little bit at arm's length or laughing at it is helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And this was during the Corzine administration?
Yeah, it was the tail end. Well, it was 2005.
Okay.
Yeah,
and then when he ran for reelection, you were selected as his running mate.
Yeah, that came after Chris Christie had the perp walk.
Right. Operation Bidrig.
Right.
Right, right.
Where
and
everybody was getting indicted.
And the party boss who opposed you was caught up in that, correct?
Yeah. Well, I think he was caught up, but I don't know that it was directly involved with that. But he was caught up in his own issues. So I was picked because that defines somebody who was not involved in any way, shape, or form, or related to. And
you had literally opposed the people who were caught up in
so
it.
So I had the gravitas to stand up. Also, I was from Bergen County. They wanted somebody who could win
North
Bergen
Jersey.
County, which we did, not by a large enough majority to offset Ocean County. And I had, again, a learning experience. I had a great time in that campaign, as I tell everybody, except for the losing part. I mean, it was a campaign that I wasn't in charge of, that I was very happy. They sent somebody to pick me up every morning. I go out and meet people, give speeches, get applauded, and come home at night. What was not to like?
Not bad, yeah.
So it was fun, and I learned, that's where I learned a lot about the state itself. I used to kid Joe Roberts when he was a majority leader in the assembly and then speaker, that I thought Trenton was South Jersey.
Right.
I didn't know there was a whole state down there. And I learned so much about about how interesting the state is and the people who live here.
Right, I'm sure. So Chris Christie then became governor, and you had some public tussles with him.
That's right.
But I think what you're probably, you know, most known for and remembered for is chairing the special investigative committee into the Bridgegate
hearing,
hearing scandal, whatever it was.
Well, you notice my office has a lot of orange cones.
I see. There's a lot of traffic cones around here.
A lot of orange traffic cones and a few baseball bats that have been presented.
Yes. You basically live in the shadow of the George Washington Bridge.
Yes, which is what got me involved.
Right.
I read The Road Warrior, who wrote the first story about what's going on here. We started getting calls from constituents. I am stuck in a three. It's the third day. I can't move, et cetera. So I said to, it was a sheer whim, something's going on here. Why don't we go to a Port Authority meeting? I'd never been, shame on me, to a Port Authority meeting, which I say most legislators haven't. It's an agency that has a budget bigger than 26 states.
Wow.
We should have paid more attention to it. So whoever the staffer looked it up online, and there was no Port Authority meeting coming up, but there was a subcommittee, ethics and governance.
So this was after the lanes had been closed. People obviously, I mean, it was, I think it was the first day of school that day.
Yes, it was the first day of school.
It was
the
nightmare.
Week of Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. The first day of school, I mean, it was just the worst possible
time. And it was called a traffic study. And then the rumors started to come out that perhaps it wasn't a traffic study.
Yeah, I was in California for Thanksgiving. I had already been to one of those subcommittee meetings, which I can talk about later. But I was in California for Thanksgiving with my family, and I usually come home on Tuesday after because I don't like getting involved with the big travels. So it was Monday was the hearing where Bill Baroni came and testified before the Transportation Committee about the traffic study.
That was a traffic study. Former Senator Bill Baroni, who was a colleague of yours in the Senate.
Yes. With whom I had worked on marriage equality. He was the only Republican publicly supporting marriage equality. So I felt, you know, we had a friendship. And I'm listening to him talking about these so-called private lanes that go for Fort Lee residents only. So I'm sitting in the kitchen in California by myself, watching on my iPad, and I'm thinking, well, what is he talking about? So I actually called Mark Sokolich,
Mayor of Fort Lee.
And I said, are there some kind of private roads that go over the George Washington Bridge that I don't know about? So he said, I don't know what you're talking about. So I said, well, I think you should go turn on that hearing. I knew at that moment that he was making the story up, that those streets didn't exist. Therefore, what could they be studying?
Right.
I knew it while I was sitting 3,000 miles away, came home, and continued going to Port Authority meetings. And the second meeting that I went to, either toward the end of November of 13 or December, I brought a few people with me. Then Freeholder Jim Tedesco, not yet county executive in Bergen County, and John Wisniewski, who was chair of the Transportation Committee. And John, afterwards, you know, we all got up to speak. And actually, Tedesco, I thought, did such a great job because he said, unscripted, to the commissioners, who had been very dismissive of me the last couple of times I'd been there, he said, you know, you don't know whose lives you affected here. You might have had somebody who was going in for a job interview, sure, finally going to get a job, mm-hmm, and lost out because he couldn't make it, or somebody going to a doctor's office for a very serious diagnosis. And he went through these kind of, you know, to make it real as to what, you know, you really did things to people's lives here. And John Wisniewski came up to me afterwards and he said, look, I have on the Transportation Committee, I have subpoena power, which they had gotten from some a year before,
right.
I think.
Not every committee has,
yeah,
subpoena power.
But yeah, they had gotten subpoena power. He said, we could use it, but I don't want to step on your toes. And I said, feel free.
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So he went and subpoenaed the first documents, mm-hmm, that ended up with the time for traffic in Fort Lee.
Right.
But even it was before the Bridgegate Committee was set up, the Joint Committee. He and for that I have always thanked him. He was always respectful. Mm-hmm. He included me, even though I wasn't a member of the Assembly Transportation Committee, and their deliberations, asked me to sit back there with him. So always was respectful of the fact that I had kind of brought it,
right,
forward and didn't stand in his way, which I wouldn't, mm-hmm, to move it forward. And that's where the first documents came from, and,
yep,
and the Joint Committee. And as I said to somebody, the biggest problem we had was getting them both of us in the same camera frame, because he's like,
right,
6'5", and you know, I'm barely 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got me a box to stand on, because otherwise it was, you know, almost funny to
right,
look at.
Right, right.
So hence, when we had our first press gaggle after the Katie Brennan hearing the
right,
other day, Eliana Pintor-Moran, who is my co-chair from the Assembly, mm-hmm, who's not nearly as tall as John Wisniewski, but is taller than I am, said to me, I wore flats in your honor today. So that, I said, that's more than John ever did,
yeah,
for me.
So speaking of, you now find yourself co-chairing yet another special investigative committee.
Yeah, more difficult in some ways.
Yeah, by way of a little background, there was an alleged sexual assault, mm-hmm, between two campaign workers on the governor's campaign. Both of those individuals ended up getting jobs, high-ranking jobs within,
correct,
the administration. And even after Ms. Brennan, who was the victim, let people know what had happened, she went to the police and...
She did. Katie Brennan did, according to what she told us,
mm-hmm,
everything by the book. The night of the, which she describes as a rape,
mm-hmm,
stronger word than assault, stronger word in people's minds.
Right.
She called two friends because she was so upset. She called her husband, who was apparently
overseas, yeah,
studying in a Fulbright scholarship or something. And then the next morning, she went to the Jersey City Police Department and filed a police report. And then the following day, went to Jersey City Medical Center, got an examination, a rape kit, which then triggers the county prosecutor getting involved.
Right.
So that's the outline of the doing everything by the book.
And on a parallel track, the people that you told were fellow campaign workers who also got jobs in the administration.
Right.
So there was this now scenario where everybody involved is working in the administration and nothing had really been done about it.
Yeah, well, up to today.
Until she went to the Wall Street Journal.
So she
right,
felt that her only avenue was to go to the Wall Street Journal,
mm-hmm,
or to go to a newspaper.
Press, yeah.
And the Wall Street Journal, if there were several weeks there where everybody, the rumors were flying that this story was imminent. Everybody were buzzing about it. Nobody knew what it was going to say. And then the article finally did come out, and it was quite detailed. Mm-hmm. And what she raised are some pretty serious accusations. The accused gets a high-level job in January after she has reported the prior April mm-hmm. this alleged incident takes place. Now, he is under investigation, but not charged. So on the other side of the coin, you can say, well, you've got a guy who hasn't been charged with anything. Does that mean he's not allowed to work?
Right.
So those are the kinds of questions that we have to answer as we continue getting testimony, which we will on December 18th.
18th, right.
Yeah, Tuesday, December 18th, which is our next hearing, and the next one after that is January 8th. So we have a whole series of witnesses lined up. Thus far, the governor's office has been cooperative, and they haven't said no to any of the witnesses we've requested. We haven't had to do subpoenas mm-hmm. because they have been cooperative.
They've been complying with it.
Yeah.
Are there any lessons that you learned from the Bridgegate hearings that can be applicable to now this?
Well, it's a lesson everybody should have known.
Right.
It's the cover-up.
Again, it's right. It's a cover-up.
It's not the incident. I don't think we ever got to the real nugget of truth in the Bridgegate. I think we have, in this hearing, better advice, more involved legal team mm-hmm. than we did before. So I think that's improved the process. But it's always the cover-up, and I don't know why people should have learned that lesson by now.
Right, right.
So it was the crazy. Would Bill Baroni be in the trouble he's in if he hadn't gone to make up a story about a non-existent traffic study?
Mm-hmm. So it's I guess we'll see. We're right in the middle now of these investigative right. hearings, and the governor said that he would comply. There's been some tension between the governor and the legislature, specifically right. the Senate president. Where do you think is that something that you think they can work through, or is it, you know?
Well, yes, I think it can be worked through, but it can only be worked through with meetings,
right?
With interchanges. Mm-hmm. I think that Governor Murphy came in. He philosophically represents a lot of the things I believe in. Mm-hmm. But he came in with a comparatively new staff of inexperienced people, by and large, with the exception of a couple. And I think there should have been much more interchange between him and the legislative leadership. Certainly not too late. Mm-hmm. He's not even a year in office yet, although mm-hmm. he's getting pretty close. So we went through the bump of the issues around the budget, but it was solved, and we got a budget for yep. the state of New Jersey. Again, the first 3 months he was in office, he signed bills that I've been working on for 8 years. Women's health, earned sick leave, the strongest pay equity law in the nation, which I had been working on and passed year after year, mm-hmm. and Christie vetoed year after year, and I stood up at press conferences year after year, finally got a governor who had a signing pen.
Right.
So what I say is he can't get anything done that we don't pass, and we can't get anything done that he doesn't sign. Mm-hmm. So we have to have a cooperative relationship. Now, will there be differences of opinion? Yes. That's where the word compromise comes in. Sometimes you compromise more than you like, or sometimes you say, this is the line in the sand, and I'm not going beyond it. But you can't do that without sitting across a table.
Right.
And working together. And, you know, I sometimes refer to the governor and my Senate president as the two tall Irish guys. So they have to find a way to have much better communications, being able to do it on a regular basis where just the two leaders can sit with the governor from time to time, and then our larger leadership in both houses.
Because for the most part, you know, it's not ideological differences. that's
no, well, there are
part.
Some ideological differences. Some how we
nuance,
get to $15,
right.
you know,
wage,
and
yeah.
this new redistricting plan. But we're never going to solve those if we don't have a forum to sit down and argue it out. Mm-hmm. That's what you do in government. I mean, you even, not to any great end, but you even saw it in the White House with Nancy, Chuck, and the president
right,
screaming
right.
at one another
that was
on camera.
Soon. Right, 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 right.
So,
lessons learned
yeah.
from a lifetime in politics.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And it continues to yeah. never get dull for you.
Yeah. I often say that, you know, I still have a passion for all of it, and I wish there was some kind of an antidote, mm-hmm. a pill I could take to, like, not get, you know, not get so involved. You know, I could hear my husband's voice saying to me, do you have to get involved in every single issue that comes down the pike? And one day I was sitting in the assembly soon after he passed away, and there was some issue there that I was determined I was not going to get involved in. Somebody got up and made a really stupid remark. So I pressed my speak button and I looked up and sort of said to myself, sorry, Irwin. So I thought, well, I don't know, people understand that I was communicating.
Right, right.
But I had to get up to speak anyway. But so, you know, I think I've learned a little bit about parameters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think I get involved in every single issue, and maybe only every other one.
Yeah. So. Well, this has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
I'm going to end with kind of a fun little game, Fast Five. So I'll ask you five random questions.
Okay.
First thing that comes to your mind. What's your favorite movie?
My favorite movie would be Casablanca.
Mm-hmm. Favorite book that's had an impact on your life in some way?
I think... Actually, Jane Eyre.
Okay. What do you miss most about California?
My grandchildren and the weather.
The weather. Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. What does New Jersey have that California doesn't?
A state legislature.
Okay. Maybe better food, too?
Yeah. Actually, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, except... Well, there's certain South Asian food that
right.
California has. Mexican food. Mm-hmm. Used to be we didn't have Mexican food here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when I went home, that would be my first, oh, God, I need my Mexican food fix. But now we have good Mexican restaurants
yeah,
here, too.
Yeah.
yeah.
And finally, what is one of your New Year's resolutions?
Well, I haven't gotten there yet.
I haven't gotten there yet.
No.
We've...
No, it's only, I mean, what are we, December 10th?
Yeah, that's true.
yeah.
We'll see how the committee goes next
yeah,
week.
That's right.
Senator, thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Thank
it's
you.
It's been a great conversation.
Thanks, Paul. It was fun.
Absolutely.